Preface to The Adventures of Gerard. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Adventures of Gerard by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Preface. I hope that some readers may possibly be interested in these little tales of the Napoleonic soldiers, to the extent of following them up to the springs from which they flow. The age was rich in military material, some of it the most human and most picturesque that I have ever read. Setting aside historical works, or the biographies of the leaders, there is a mass of evidence written by the actual fighting men themselves, which describes their feelings and their experiences, stated always from the point of view of the particular branch of the service to which they belonged. The cavalry were particularly happy in their writers of memoirs. Thus de Rocca, in his Memoir sur la guerre des Français en Espagne, has given the narrative of a hussar, while de Nelly, in his Memoir sur la guerre d'Espagne, gives the same campaign from the point of view of the dragoon. Then we have the Souvenir militaire du colonel de Gonville, which treats a series of wars, including that of Spain, as seen from under the steel-brimmed, hair-crested helmet of a cuirassier. Preeminent among all these works, and among all military memoirs, are the famous reminiscences of Marbot, which can be obtained in an English form. Marbot was a chasseur, so again we obtain the cavalry point of view. Among other books which help one to an understanding of the Napoleonic soldier, I would specially recommend Les Cahiers du Capitaine Cognet, which treat the wars from the point of view of the private of the guards, and Les Mémoires du Sergent Bourgon, who was a non-commissioned officer in the same corps. The Journal of Sergeant Fricasse and the Recollections of de Fesnay and of de Segur complete the materials from which I have worked in my endeavour to give a true historical and military atmosphere to an imaginary figure. Arthur Conan Doyle, March 1903. End of Preface. Section 1 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Philip Griffiths. How Brigadier Gerard Lost His Ear. It was the old brigadier who was talking in the café. I have seen a great many cities, my friends. I would not dare to tell you how many I have entered as a conqueror with 800 of my little fighting devils clanking and jingling behind me. The cavalry were in front of the Grand Army, and the Hussars of Conflans were in front of the cavalry, and I was in front of the Hussars. But of all the cities which we visited, Venice is the most ill-built and ridiculous. I cannot imagine how the people who laid it out thought that the cavalry could manoeuvre. It would puzzle Murat or La Salle to bring a squadron into that square of theirs. For this reason we left Kellerman's heavy brigade and also my own hussars at Padua on the mainland. But Suchet with the infantry held the town, and he had chosen me as his aide-de-camp for that winter because he was pleased about the affair of the Italian fencing master at Milan. The fellow was a good swordsman, and it was fortunate for the credit of French arms that it was I who was opposed to him. Besides, he deserved a lesson, for if one does not like a prima donna's singing, one can always be silent, but it is intolerable that a public affront should be put upon a pretty woman. So the sympathy was all with me, and after the affair had blown over, and the man's widow had been pensioned, Suchet chose me as his own galloper, and I followed him to Venice, where I had the strange adventure which I am about to tell you. You have not been to Venice? No, for it is seldom that the French travel. We were great travellers in those days. From Moscow to Cairo we had travelled everywhere, but we went in larger parties than were convenient to those whom we visited, and we carried our passports in our limbers. It will be a bad day for Europe when the French start travelling again, for they are slow to leave their homes, but when they have done so, No one can say how far they will go if they have a guide like our little man to point out the way. But the great days are gone, and the great men are dead, and here am I, the last of them, drinking wine of Suresne and telling old tales in a cafe. But it is of Venice that I would speak. The folk there live like water rats upon a mud bank, but the houses are very fine, and the churches, especially that of St. Mark, are as great as any I have seen. But above all, they are proud of their statues and their pictures, which are the most famous in Europe. There are many soldiers who think that because one's trade is to make war, one should never have a thought above fighting and plunder. There was old Bouvet, for example, the one who was killed by the Prussians on the day that I won the Emperor's medal. If you took him away from the camp and the canteen and spoke to him of books or of art, he would sit and stare at you. But the highest soldier is a man like myself, who can understand the things of the mind and the soul. It is true that I was very young when I joined the army, and that the quartermaster was my only teacher. But if you go about the world with your eyes open, you cannot help learning a great deal. Thus I was able to admire the pictures in Venice, and to know the names of the great men, Michael Titiens and Angelus, and the others who had painted them. No one can say that Napoleon did not admire them also, for the very first thing which he did when he captured the town was to send the best of them to Paris. We all took what we could get, and I had two pictures for my share. One of them, called Nymphs Surprised, I kept for myself, and the other, St. Barbara, I sent as a present for my mother. It must be confessed, however, that some of our men behaved very badly in this matter of the statues and the pictures. The people at Venice were very much attached to them, and as to the four bronze horses which stood over the gate of their great church, they loved them as dearly as if they had been their children. I have always been a judge of a horse, and I had a good look at these ones, but I could not see that there was much to be said for them. They were too coarse-limbed for light cavalry charges, and they had not the weight for the gun teams. However, they were the only four horses alive or dead in the whole town, so it was not to be expected that the people would know any better. They wept bitterly when they were sent away, and 10 French soldiers were found floating in the canals that night. As a punishment for these murders, a great many more of their pictures were sent away, and the soldiers took to breaking the statues and firing their muskets at the stained glass windows. This made the people furious, and there was very bad feeling in the town. Many officers and men disappeared during that winter, and even their bodies were never found. For myself, I had plenty to do, and I never found the time heavy on my hands. In every country it has been my custom to try to learn the language. For this reason, I always look round for some lady who will be kind enough to teach it to me, and then we practice it together. This is the most interesting way of picking it up, and before I was 30, I could speak nearly every tongue in Europe. But it must be confessed that what you learn is not of much use for the ordinary purposes of life. My business, for example, has usually been with soldiers and peasants, and what advantage is it to be able to say to them that I love only them and that I will come back when the wars are over? Never have I had so sweet a teacher as in Venice. Lucia was her first name, and her second, but a gentleman forgets second names. I can say this with all discretion, that she was one of the senatorial families of Venice, and that her grandfather had been doge of the town. She was of an exquisite beauty, and when I, Etienne Gerard, use such a word as exquisite, my friends, it has a meaning. I have judgment, I have memories, I have the means of comparison. Of all the women who have loved me, there are not 20 to whom I could apply such a term as that. But I say again, Lucia was exquisite. Of the dark type, I do not recall her equal, unless it were Dolores of Toledo. There was a little brunette whom I loved at Santarem, when I was soldiering under Messina in Portugal. Her name has escaped me. She was of a perfect beauty, but she had not the figure nor the grace of Lucia. There was Agnes also. I could not put one before the other, but I do none an injustice when I say that Lucia was the equal of the best. It was over this matter of pictures that I had first met her, for her father owned a palace on the farther side of the Rialto Bridge, upon the Grand Canal, and it was so packed with wall paintings that Suchet sent a party of sappers to cut some of them out and send them to Paris. I had gone down with them, and after I had seen Lucia in tears, it appeared to me that the plaster would crack if it were taken from the support of the wall. I said so, and the sappers were withdrawn. After that I was the friend of the family, and many a flask of Chianti have I cracked with the father, and many a sweet lesson have I had from the daughter. Some of our French officers married in Venice that winter, and I might have done the same, for I loved her with all my heart. But Etienne Gerard has his sword, his horse, his regiment, his mother, his emperor, and his career. A debonair hussar has room in his life for love, but none for a wife. So I thought then, my friends, but I did not see the lonely days when I should long to clasp those vanished hands and turn my head away when I saw old comrades with their tall children standing round their chairs. This love which I had thought was a joke and a plaything, it is only now that I understand that it is the moulder of one's life, the most solemn and sacred of all things. Thank you, my friend, thank you. It is a good wine, and a second bottle cannot hurt. And now I will tell you how my love for Lucia was the cause of one of the most terrible of all the wonderful adventures which have ever befallen me, and how it was that I came to lose the top of my right ear. You have often asked me why it was missing. Tonight, for the first time, I will tell you. Suchet's headquarters at that time was the old palace of the Doge d'Andelot, which stands on the lagoon not far from the Place of San Marco. It was near the end of the winter, and I had returned one night from the Theatre Goldini, when I found a note from Lucia and a gondola waiting. She prayed me to come to her at once, as she was in trouble. To a Frenchman and a soldier there was but one answer to such a note. In an instant I was in the boat, and the gondolier was pushing out into the dark lagoon. I remember that as I took my seat in the boat I was struck by the man's great size. He was not tall, but he was one of the broadest men that I have ever seen in my life. But the gondoliers of Venice are a strong breed, and powerful men are common enough among them. The fellow took his place behind me and began to row. A good soldier in an enemy's country should everywhere and at all times be on the alert. It has been one of the rules of my life, and if I have lived to wear grey hairs, it is because I have observed it. And yet, upon that night, I was as careless as a foolish young recruit who fears lest he should be thought to be afraid. My pistols I had left behind in my hurry, my sword was at my belt, but it is not always the most convenient of weapons. I lay back in my seat in the gondola, lulled by the gentle swish of the water and the steady creaking of the oar. Our way lay through a network of narrow canals, with high houses towering on either side, and a thin slit of star-spangled sky above us. Here and there, on the bridges which spanned the canal, there was the dim glimmer of an oil lamp, and sometimes there came a gleam from some niche where a candle burned before the image of a saint. But save for this it was all black, and one could only see the water by the white fringe which curled round the long black nose of our boat. It was a place and a time for dreaming. I thought of my own past life, of all the great deeds in which I have been concerned, of the horses that I had handled, and of the women that I had loved. Then I thought also of my dear mother, and I fancied her joy when she heard the folk in the village talking about the fame of her son. Of the Emperor also I thought, and of France, the dear fatherland, the sunny France, mother of beautiful daughters and of gallant sons. My heart glowed within me as I thought of how we had brought her colours so many hundred leagues beyond her borders. To her greatness I would dedicate my life. I placed my hand upon my heart as I swore it, and at that instant the gondolier fell upon me from behind. When I say that he fell upon me, I do not mean merely that he attacked me, but that he really did tumble upon me with all his weight. The fellow stands behind you and above you as he rose, so that you can neither see him nor can you in any way guard against such an assault. One moment I had sat with my mind filled with sublime resolutions, the next I was flattened out upon the bottom of the boat, the breath dashed out of my body, and this monster pinning me down. I felt the fierce pants of his hot breath upon the back of my neck. In an instant he had torn away my sword, had slipped a sack over my head, and had tied a rope firmly round the outside of it. There I was, at the bottom of the gondola, as helpless as a trussed fowl. I could not shout, I could not move, I was a mere bundle. An instant later I heard once more the swishing of the water and the creaking of the oar. This fellow had done his work and had resumed his journey as quietly and unconcernedly as if he were accustomed to clap a sack over a colonel of hussars every day of the week. I cannot tell you the humiliation and also the fury which filled my mind as I lay there like a helpless sheep being carried to the butchers. I, Etienne Gerard, the champion of the 6 brigades of light cavalry and the first swordsman of the Grand Army, to be overpowered by a single unarmed man in such a fashion. Yet I lay quiet, for there is a time to resist and there is a time to save one's strength. I had felt the fellow's grip upon my arms, and I knew that I would be a child in his hands. I waited quietly, therefore, with a heart which burned with rage, until my opportunity should come. How long I lay there at the bottom of the boat I cannot tell, but it seemed to me to be a long time, and always there were the hiss of the waters and the steady creaking of the oar. Several times we turned corners, for I heard the long, sad cry which these gondoliers give when they wish to warn their fellows that they are coming. At last, after a considerable journey, I felt the side of the boat scrape up against the landing place. The fellow knocked 3 times with his oar upon wood, and in answer to his summons I heard the rasping of bars and the turning of keys. A great door creaked back upon its hinges. "Have you got him?" asked a voice in Italian. My monster gave a laugh and kicked the sack in which I lay. "Here he is," said he. "They are waiting." He added something which I could not understand. "Take him, then," said my captor. He raised me in his arms, ascended some steps, and I was thrown down upon a hard floor. A moment later the bars creaked and the key whined once more. I was a prisoner inside a house. From the voices and the steps there seemed now to be several people round me. I understand Italian a great deal better than I speak it, and I could make out very well what they were saying. "You have not killed him, Matteo?" "What matter if I have?" "My faith, you will have to answer for it to the tribunal." "They will kill him, will they not?" "Yes, but it is not for you or me to take it out of their hands." "Tut, I have not killed him. Dead men do not bite, and his cursed teeth met in my thumb as I pulled the sack over his head. He lies very quiet." "Tumble him out, and you will find that he is lively enough." The cord which bound me was undone, and the sack drawn from over my head. With my eyes closed, I lay motionless upon the floor. "By the saints, Matteo, I tell you that you have broken his neck." "Not I. He has only fainted. The better for him if he never came out of it again." I felt a hand within my tunic. "Matteo is right," said a voice. "His heart beat like a hammer. Let him lie, and he will soon find his senses." I waited for a minute or so, and then I ventured to take a stealthy peep from between my lashes. At first I could see nothing, for I had been so long in darkness, and it was but a dim light in which I found myself. Soon, however, I made out that a high and vaulted ceiling covered with painted gods and goddesses was arching over my head. This was no mean den of cutthroats into which I had been carried, but it must be the hall of some Venetian palace. Then, without movement, very slowly and stealthily, I had a peep at the men who surrounded me. There was the gondolier, a swart, hard-faced, murderous ruffian, and beside him were 3 other men, one of them a little twisted fellow, with an air of authority and several keys in his hand. The other two, tall young servants in a smart livery. As I listened to their talk, I saw that the small man was the steward of the house, and that the others were under his orders. There were four of them then, but the little steward might be left out of the reckoning. Had I a weapon, I should have smiled at such odds as those. But hand to hand, I was no match for the one, even without three others to aid him. Cunning, then, not force, must be my aid. I wished to look round for some mode of escape, and in doing so I gave an almost imperceptible movement of my head. Slight as it was, it did not escape my guardians. "Come, wake up," cried the steward. "Get on your feet, little Frenchman," growled the gondolier. "Get up, I say." And for the second time he spurned me with his foot. Never in the world was a command obeyed so promptly as that one. In an instant I had bounded to my feet and rushed as hard as I could to the back of the hall. They were after me, as I have seen the English hounds follow a fox, but there was a long passage down which I tore. It turned to the left and again to the left, and then I found myself back in the hall once more. They were almost within touch of me, and there was no time for thought. I turned towards the staircase, but two men were coming down it. I dodged back and tried the door through which I had been brought, but it was fastened with great bars and I could not loosen them. The gondolier was on me with his knife, but I met him with a kick on the body which stretched him on his back. His dagger flew with a clatter across the marble floor. I had no time to seize it, for there were half a dozen of them now clutching at me. As I rushed through them, the little steward thrust his leg before me, and I fell with a crash. But I was up in an instant, and breaking from their grasp, I burst through the very middle of them, and made for a door at the other end of the hall. I reached it well in front of them, and I gave a shout of triumph as the handle turned freely in my hand, for I could see that it led to the outside, and that all was clear for my escape. But I had forgotten this strange city in which I was. Every house is an island. As I flung open the door, ready to bound out into the street, the light of the hall shone upon the deep, still, black water, which lay flush with the topmost step. I shrank back, and in an instant my pursuers were on me. But I am not taken so easily. Again I kicked and fought my way through them, though one of them tore a handful of hair from my head in his effort to hold me. The little steward struck me with a key, and I was battered and bruised, but once more I cleared a way in front of me. Up the grand staircase I rushed, burst open the pair of huge folding doors which faced me, and learned at last that my efforts were in vain. End of section one. Section 2 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. How Brigadier Gerard Lost His Ear. Continued. The room into which I had broken was brilliantly lighted, with its gold cornices, its massive pillars, and its painted walls and ceilings. It was evidently the grand hall of some famous Venetian palace. There are many hundreds such in this strange city, any one of which has rooms which would grace the Louvre or Versailles. In the centre of this great hall there was a raised dais, and upon it, in a half-circle, there sat 12 men all clad in black gowns, like those of a Franciscan monk, and each with a mask over the upper part of his face. A group of armed men, rough-looking rascals, were standing round the door, and amid them, facing the dais, was a young fellow in the uniform of the light infantry. As he turned his head, I recognised him. It was Captain Auray of the 7th, a young Basque with whom I had drunk many a glass during the winter. He was deadly white, poor wretch, but he held himself manfully amid the assassins who surrounded him. Never shall I forget the sudden flash of hope which shone in his dark eyes when he saw a comrade burst into the room, or the look of despair which followed, as he understood that I had come not to change his fate, but to share it. You can think how amazed these people were when I hurled myself into their presence. My pursuers had crowded in behind me and choked the doorway, so that all further flight was out of the question. It is at such instants that my nature asserts itself. With dignity I advanced toward the tribunal. My jacket was torn, my hair was dishevelled, my head was bleeding, but there was that in my eyes and in my carriage which made them realize that no common man was before them. Not a hand was raised to arrest me until I halted in front of a formidable old man whose long grey beard and masterful manner told me that both by years and by character he was the man in authority. "Sir," said I, "you will perhaps tell me why I have been forcibly arrested and brought to this place. I am an honourable soldier, as is this other gentleman here, and I demand that you will instantly set us both at liberty." There was an appalling silence to my appeal. It was not pleasant to have 12 masked faces turned upon you and to see 12 pairs of vindictive Italian eyes fixed with fierce intentness upon your face. But I stood as a debonair soldier should, and I could not but reflect how much credit I was bringing upon the Hussars of Conflans by the dignity of my bearing. I do not think that anyone could have carried himself better under such difficult circumstances. I looked with a fearless face from one assassin to another, and I waited for some reply. It was the greybeard who at last broke the silence. "Who is this man?" he asked. "His name is Gerard," said the little steward at the door. "Colonel Gerard," said I, "I will not deceive you. I am Etienne Gerard, the Colonel Gerard, 5 times mentioned in dispatches and recommended for the sword of honour. I am aide-de-camp to General Suchet, and I demand my instant release, together with that of my comrade-in-arms." The same terrible silence fell upon the assembly, and the same 12 pairs of merciless eyes were bent upon my face. Again it was the greybeard who spoke. "He is out of his order. There are 2 names upon our list before him. He escaped from our hands and burst into the room. Let him await his turn. Take him down to the wooden cell. If he resists us, Your Excellency, bury your knives in his body. The tribunal will uphold you. Remove him until we have dealt with the others." They advanced upon me, and for an instant I thought of resistance. It would have been a heroic death, but who was there to see it or to chronicle it? I might be only postponing my fate, and yet I had been in so many bad places and come out unhurt that I had learned always to hope and to trust my star. I allowed these rascals to seize me, and I was led from the room, the gondolier walking at my side with a long naked knife in his hand. I could see in his brutal eyes the satisfaction which it would give him if he could find some excuse for plunging it into my body. They are wonderful places, these great Venetian houses, palaces and fortresses and prisons all in one. I was led along a passage and down a bare stone stair until we came to a short corridor from which 3 doors opened. Through one of these I was thrust, and the spring lock closed behind me. The only light came dimly through a small grating which opened on the passage. Peering and feeling, I carefully examined the chamber in which I had been placed. I understood from what I had heard that I should soon have to leave it again in order to appear before this tribunal, but still it is not my nature to throw away any possible chances. The stone floor of the cell was so damp, and the walls for some feet high were so slimy and foul, that it was evident that they were beneath the level of the water. A single slanting hole high up near the ceiling was the only aperture for light or air. Through it I saw one bright star shining down upon me, and the sight filled me with comfort and with hope. I have never been a man of religion, though I have always had a respect for those who were, but I remember that night that the star shining down the shaft seemed to be an all-seeing eye which was upon me, and I felt as a young and frightened recruit might feel in battle when he saw the calm gaze of his colonel turned upon him. 3 of the sides of my prison were formed of stone, but the 4th was of wood, and I could see that it had only recently been erected. Evidently a partition had been thrown up to divide a single large cell into 2 smaller ones. There was no hope for me in the old walls, in the tiny window, or in the massive door. It was only in this one direction of the wooden screen that there was any possibility of exploring. My reason told me that if I should pierce it, which did not seem very difficult, it would only be to find myself in another cell as strong as that in which I then was. Yet I had always rather be doing something than doing nothing, so I bent all my attention and all my energies upon the wooden wall. Two planks were badly joined and so loose that I was certain I could easily detach them. I searched about for some tool, and I found one in the leg of a small bed which stood in the corner. I forced the end of this into the chink of the planks, and I was about to twist them outward when the sound of rapid footsteps caused me to pause and to listen. I wish I could forget what I heard. Many a hundred men have I seen die in battle, and I have slain more myself than I care to think of, but all that was fair fight and the duty of a soldier. It was a very different matter to listen to a murder in this den of assassins. They were pushing someone along the passage, someone who resisted and who clung to my door as he passed. They must have taken him into the third cell, the one which was farthest from me. "Help! Help!" cried a voice, and then I heard a blow and a scream. "Help! Help!" cried the voice again, and then, "Gerard! Colonel Gerard!" It was my poor captain of infantry whom they were slaughtering. "Murderers! Murderers!" I yelled, and I kicked at my door. But again I heard him shout, and then everything was silent. A minute later there was a heavy splash, and I knew that no human eye would ever see Array again. He had gone as 100 others had gone whose names were missing from the roll calls of their regiments during that winter in Venice. The steps returned along the passage, and I thought that they were coming for me. Instead of that, they opened the door of the cell next to mine, and they took someone out of it. I heard the steps die away up the stair. At once I renewed my work upon the planks, and within a very few minutes I had loosened them in such a way that I could remove and replace them at pleasure. Passing through the aperture, I found myself in the farther cell, which, as I expected, was the other half of the one in which I had been confined. I was not any nearer to escape than I had been before, for there was no other wooden wall which I could penetrate, and the spring lock of the door had been closed. There were no traces to show who was my companion in misfortune. Closing the two loose planks behind me, I returned to my own cell and waited there with all the courage which I could command for the summons which would probably be my death knell. It was a long time in coming, but at last I heard the sound of feet once more in the passage, and I nerved myself to listen to some other odious deed and to hear the cries of the poor victim. Nothing of the kind occurred, however, and the prisoner was placed in the cell without violence. I had no time to peep through my hole of communication, for next moment my own door was flung open, and my rascally gondolier, with the other assassins, came into the cell. "Come, Frenchman," said he. He held his blood-stained knife in his great hairy hand, and I read in his fierce eyes that he only looked for some excuse in order to plunge it into my heart. Resistance was useless. I followed without a word. I was led up the stone stair and back into that gorgeous chamber in which I had left the secret tribunal. I was ushered in, but to my surprise, it was not on me that their attention was fixed. One of their own number, a tall, dark young man, was standing before them and was pleading with them in low, earnest tones. His voice quivered with anxiety and his hands darted in and out, or writhed together in an agony of entreaty. "You cannot do it! You cannot do it!" he cried. "I implore the tribunal to reconsider this decision." "Stand aside, brother," said the old man who presided. "The case is decided, and another is up for judgment."
"For heaven's sake, be merciful!" cried the young man.
"We have already been merciful," the other answered. "Death would have been a small penalty for such an offence. Be silent and let judgment take its course." I saw the young man throw himself in an agony of grief into his chair. I had no time, however, to speculate as to what it was which was troubling him, for his 11 colleagues had already fixed their stern eyes upon me. The moment of fate had arrived. "You are Colonel Gerard," said the terrible old man. "I am."
aide-de-camp to the robber who calls himself General Suchet, who in turn represents that arch-robber Bonaparte. It was on my lips to tell him that he was a liar. But there is a time to argue and a time to be silent. I am an honourable soldier, said I. I have obeyed my orders and done my duty. The blood flushed into the old man's face, and his eyes blazed through his mask. You are thieves and murderers, every man of you, he cried. What are you doing here? You are Frenchmen. Why are you not in France? Did we invite you to Venice? By what right are you here? Where are our pictures? Where are the horses of St. Mark? Who are you that you should pilfer those treasures which our fathers through so many centuries have collected? We were a great city when France was a desert. Your drunken, brawling, ignorant soldiers have undone the work of saints and heroes. What have you to say to it? He was indeed a formidable old man, for his white beard bristled with fury, and he barked out the little sentences like a savage hound. For my part, I could have told him that his pictures would be safe in Paris, that his horses were really not worth making a fuss about, and that he could see heroes, I say nothing of saints, without going back to his ancestors, or even moving out of his chair. All this I could have pointed out, but one might as well argue with a Mameluke about religion. I shrugged my shoulders and said nothing. The prisoner has no defence, said one of my masked judges. Has anyone any observation to make before judgment is passed? The old man glared round him at the others. There is one matter, Your Excellency, said another. It can scarce be referred to without reopening a brother's wounds, but I would remind you that there is a very particular reason why an exemplary punishment should be inflicted in the case of this officer. I had not forgotten it, the old man answered. Brother, if the tribunal has injured you in one direction, it will give you ample satisfaction in another. The young man, who had been pleading when I entered the room, staggered to his feet. I cannot endure it, he cried. Your Excellency must forgive me. The tribunal can act without me. I am ill. I am mad. He flung his hands out with a furious gesture and rushed from the room. Let him go, let him go, said the President. It is indeed more than can be asked of flesh and blood that he should remain under this roof. But he is a true Venetian, and when the first agony is over, he will understand that it could not be otherwise. I had been forgotten during this episode, and though I am not a man who is accustomed to being overlooked, I should have been all the happier had they continued to neglect me. But now the old President glared at me again like a tiger who comes back to his victim. You shall pay for it all, and it is but justice that you should, he said. You, an upstart adventurer and foreigner, have dared to raise your eyes in love to the granddaughter of a Doge of Venice, who was already betrothed to the heir of the Lordans. He who enjoys such privileges must pay a price for them. It cannot be higher than they are worth, said I. You will tell us that when you have made a part payment, said he. Perhaps your spirit may not be so proud by that time. Matteo, you will lead this prisoner to the wooden cell. Tonight's Monday. Let him have no food or water, and let him be led before the tribunal again on Wednesday night. We shall then decide upon the death which he is to die. It was not a pleasant prospect, and yet it was a reprieve. One is thankful for small mercies when a hairy savage with a blood-stained knife is standing at one's elbow. He dragged me from the room, and I was thrust down the stairs and back into my cell. The door was locked, and I was left to my reflections. End of section 2. Section 3 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. How Brigadier Gerard Lost His Ear. Continued. My first thought was to establish connection with my neighbour in misfortune. I waited until the steps had died away, and then I cautiously drew aside the two boards and peeped through. The light was very dim, so dim that I could only just discern a figure huddled in the corner, and I could hear the low whisper of a voice which prayed, as one prays who is in deadly fear. The boards must have made a creaking. There was a sharp exclamation of surprise. "Courage, friend, courage!" I cried. "All is not lost. Keep a stout heart, for Etienne Gerard is by your side."
"Etienne?"
It was a woman's voice which spoke, a voice which was always music to my ears. I sprang through the gap and I flung my arms round her. "Lucia, Lucia!" I cried. It was "Etienne" and "Lucia" for some minutes, for one does not make speeches at moments like that. It was she who came to her senses first. "Oh, Etienne, they would kill you. How came you into their hands?"
"In answer to your letter."
"I wrote no letter."
"The cunning demons! But you?"
"I came also in answer to your letter."
"Lucia, I wrote no letter."
"They have trapped us both with the same bait."
"I care nothing about myself, Lucia. Besides, there is no pressing danger with me. They have simply returned me to my cell."
"Oh, Etienne, Etienne, they will kill you. Lorenzo is there."
"The old greybeard?"
"No, no, a young dark man. He loved me, and I thought I loved him until I learned what love is, Etienne. He will never forgive you. He has a heart of stone."
"Let them do what they like. They cannot rob me of the past, Lucia. But you, what about you?"
"It will be nothing, Etienne. Only a pang for an instant, and then all over. They mean it as a badge of infamy, dear, but I will carry it like a crown of honour, since it was through you that I gained it."
Her words froze my blood with horror. All my adventures were insignificant compared to this terrible shadow which was creeping over my soul.
"Lucia, Lucia," I cried, "for pity's sake, tell me what these butchers are about to do. Tell me, Lucia, tell me."
"I will not tell you, Etienne, for it would hurt you far more than it would me."
Well, I will tell you, lest you should fear it was something worse. The President has ordered that my ear be cut off, that I may be marked for ever as having loved a Frenchman."
Her ear, the dear little ear which I had kissed so often. I put my hand to each little velvet shell to make certain that this sacrilege had not yet been committed. Only over my dead body should they reach them. I swore it to her between my clenched teeth.
"You must not care, Etienne. And yet I love that you should care all the same."
"They shall not hurt you, the fiends."
"I have hopes, Etienne. Lorenzo is there. He was silent while I was judged, but he may have pleaded for me after I was gone."
"He did. I heard him."
"Then he may have softened their hearts."
I knew that it was not so, but how could I bring myself to tell her? I might as well have done so, for with the quick instinct of woman, my silence was speech to her.
"They would not listen to him. You need not fear to tell me, dear, for you will find that I am worthy to be loved by such a soldier. Where is Lorenzo now?"
"He left the hall."
"Then he may have left the house as well."
"I believe that he did."
"He has abandoned me to my fate. Etienne, Etienne, they are coming."
Afar off, I heard those fateful steps and the jingle of distant keys. What were they coming for now, since there were no other prisoners to drag to judgment? It could only be to carry out the sentence upon my darling. I stood between her and the door, with the strength of a lion in my limbs. I would tear the house down before they should touch her.
"Go back, go back," she cried. "They will murder you, Etienne. My life at least is safe. For the love you bear me, Etienne, go back." "It is nothing. I will make no sound. You will not hear that it is done."
She wrestled with me, this delicate creature, and by main force she dragged me to the opening between the cells. But a sudden thought had crossed my mind. "We may yet be saved," I whispered. "Do what I tell you at once and without argument. Go into my cell, quick."
I pushed her through the gap and helped her to replace the planks. I had retained her cloak in my hands, and with this wrapped around me, I crept into the darkest corner of her cell. There I lay when the door was opened and several men came in. I had reckoned that they would bring no lantern, for they had none with them before. To their eyes, I was only a dark blur in the corner.
"Bring a light," said one of them.
"No, no, curse it," cried a rough voice, which I knew to be that of the ruffian Matteo.
"It is not a job that I like, and the more I saw it, the less I should like it. I am sorry, Signora, but the order of the tribunal has to be obeyed." My impulse was to spring to my feet and to rush through them all and out by the open door. But how would that help Lucia? Suppose that I got clear away. She would be in their hands until I could come back for help, for single-handed I could not hope to clear a way for her. All this flashed through my mind in an instant, and I saw that the only course for me was to lie still, take what came, and wait my chance. The fellow's coarse hand felt about among my curls, those curls in which only a woman's fingers had ever wandered. The next instant he gripped my ear, and a pain shot through me, as if I had been touched with a hot iron. I bit my lip to stifle a cry, and I felt the blood run warm down my neck and back. "There, thank heaven that's over," said the fellow, giving me a friendly pat on the head. "You're a brave girl, Signora, I'll say that for you, and I only wish you'd have had better taste than to love a Frenchman. You can blame him and not me for what I have done." What could I do save to lie still and grind my teeth at my own helplessness? At the same time, my pain and my rage were always soothed by the reflection that I had suffered for the woman whom I loved. It is the custom of men to say to ladies that they would willingly endure any pain for their sake, but it was my privilege to show that I had said no more than I meant. I thought also how nobly I would seem to have acted if ever the story came to be told, and how proud the regiment of Conflans might well be of their colonel. These thoughts helped me to suffer in silence while the blood still trickled over my neck and dripped upon the stone floor. It was that sound which nearly led to my destruction. "She's bleeding fast," said one of the valets. "You had best fetch a surgeon, or you will find her dead in the morning." "She lies very still, and she has never opened her mouth," said another. "The shock has killed her." "Nonsense! A young woman does not die so easily." It was Matteo who spoke. "Besides, I did but snip off enough to leave the tribunal's mark upon her." "Rouse up, Signora, rouse up." He shook me by the shoulder, and my heart stood still for fear he should feel the epaulette under the mantle. "How is it with you now?" he asked. I made no answer. "Curse it! I wish I had to do with a man instead of a woman, and the fairest woman in Venice," said the gondolier. "Here, Nicholas, lend me your handkerchief and bring a light." It was all over. The worst had happened. Nothing could save me. I still crouched in the corner, but I was tense in every muscle, like a wild cat about to spring. If I had to die, I was determined that my end should be worthy of my life. One of them had gone for a lamp, and Matteo was stooping over me with a handkerchief. In another instant, my secret would be discovered. But he suddenly drew himself straight and stood motionless. At the same instant there came a confused murmuring sound through the little window far above my head. It was the rattle of oars and the buzz of many voices. Then there was a crash upon the door upstairs, and a terrible voice roared, "Open! Open in the name of the Emperor!" The Emperor! It was like the mention of some saint which by its very sound can frighten the demons. Away they ran with cries of terror, Matteo, the valets, the steward, all of the murderous gang. Another shout, and then the crash of a hatchet and the splintering of planks. There were the rattle of arms and the cries of French soldiers in the hall. Next instant feet came flying down the stair, and a man burst frantically into my cell. "Lucia!" he cried. "Lucia!" He stood in the dim light, panting and unable to find his words. Then he broke out again. "Have I not shown you how I love you, Lucia? What more could I do to prove it? I have betrayed my country, I have broken my vow, I have ruined my friends, and I have given my life in order to save you." It was young Lorenzo Loredan, the lover whom I had superseded. My heart was heavy for him at the time, but after all it is every man for himself in love, and if one fails in the game, it is some consolation to lose to one who can be a graceful and considerate winner. I was about to point this out to him, but at the first word I uttered he gave a shout of astonishment, and rushing out he seized the lamp which hung in the corridor and flashed it in my face. "It is you, you villain!" he cried. "You French coxcomb! You shall pay me for the wrong which you have done me!" but the next instant he saw the pallor of my face and the blood which was still pouring from my head. "What is this?" he asked. "How come you to have lost your ear?" I shook off my weakness, and pressing my handkerchief to my wound, I rose from my couch, the debonair colonel of hussars. "My injury, sir, is nothing. With your permission, we will not allude to a matter so trifling and so personal." But Lucia had burst through from her cell and was pouring out the whole story while she clasped Lorenzo's arm. "This noble gentleman, he has taken my place, Lorenzo. He has borne it for me. He has suffered that I might be saved." I could sympathize with the struggle which I could see in the Italian's face. At last he held out his hand to me. "Colonel Gerard," he said, "you are worthy of a great love. I forgive you, for if you have wronged me, you have made a noble atonement. But I wonder to see you alive. I left the tribunal before you were judged, but I understood that no mercy would be shown to any Frenchman since the destruction of the ornaments of Venice." "He did not destroy them," cried Lucia. "He has helped to preserve those in our palace." "One of them, at any rate," said I, as I stooped and kissed her hand. This was the way, my friends, in which I lost my ear. Lorenzo was found stabbed to the heart in the Piazza of St. Mark within 2 days of the night of my adventure. Of the tribunal and its ruffians, Matteo and three others were shot, the rest banished from the town. Lucia, my lovely Lucia, retired into a convent at Murano after the French had left the city, and there she still may be, some gentle lady abbess, who has perhaps long forgotten the days when our hearts throbbed together, and when the whole great world seemed so small a thing beside the love which burned in our veins. Or perhaps it may not be so. Perhaps she is not forgotten. There may still be times when the peace of the cloister is broken by the memory of the old soldier who loved her in those distant days. Youth is past and passion is gone, but the soul of the gentleman can never change. And still Etienne Gerard would bow his grey head before her, and would very gladly lose his other ear if he might do her a service. End of section 3. End of How Brigadier Gerard Lost His Ear. Section 4 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. How the Brigadier Captured Saragossa. Have I ever told you, my friends, the circumstances connected with my joining the Hussars of Conflans at the time of the siege of Saragossa, and the very remarkable exploit which I performed in connection with the taking of that city? No? Then you have indeed something still to learn. I will tell it to you exactly as it occurred. Save for 2 or 3 men and 2 of women, you are the first who have ever heard the story. You must know, then, that it was in the 2nd Hussars, called the Hussars of Chambrun, that I had served as a lieutenant and as a junior captain. At the time I speak of, I was only 25 years of age, as reckless and desperate a man as any in that great army. It chanced that the war had come to a halt in Germany, while it was still raging in Spain, so the Emperor, wishing to reinforce the Spanish army, transferred me, a senior captain, to the Hussars of Conflans, which were at that time in the 5th Army Corps, under Marshal Lannes. It was a long journey from Berlin to the Pyrenees. My new regiment formed part of the force which, under Marshal Lannes, was then besieging the Spanish town of Saragossa. I turned my horse's head in that direction, therefore, and behold me, a week or so later, at the French headquarters, whence I was directed to the camp of the Hussars of Conflans. You have read, no doubt, of this famous siege of the Saragossa, and I will only say that no general could have had a harder task than that with which Marshal Lannes was confronted. The immense city was crowded with a horde of Spaniards, soldiers, peasants, priests, all filled with the most furious hatred of the French, and the most savage determination to perish before they would surrender. There were 80,000 men in the town, and only 30,000 to besiege them, yet we had a powerful artillery, and our engineers were of the best. There was never such a siege, for it is usual that when the fortifications are taken, the city falls. But here it was not until the fortifications were taken that the real fighting began. Every house was a fort, and every street a battlefield, so that slowly, day by day, we had to work our way inwards, blowing up the houses with their garrisons, until more than half the city had disappeared. Yet the other half was as determined as ever, and in a better position for defence, since it consisted of enormous convents and monasteries with walls like the Bastille, which could not be so easily brushed out of our way. This was the state of things at the time that I joined the army. I will confess to you that cavalry are not of much use in a siege, although there was a time when I would not have permitted anyone to have made such an observation. The Hussars of Conflans were encamped to the south of the town, and it was their duty to throw out patrols and to make sure that no Spanish force was advancing from that quarter. The colonel of the regiment was not a good soldier, and the regiment was at that time very far from being in the high condition which it afterwards attained. Even in that one evening I saw several things which shocked me, for I had a high standard, and it went to my heart to see an ill-arranged camp, an ill-groomed horse, or a slovenly trooper. That night I supped with 26 of my new brother officers, and I fear that in my zeal I showed them only too plainly that I found things very different to what I was accustomed in the army of Germany. There was silence in the mess after my remarks, and I felt that I had been indiscreet when I saw the glances that were cast at me. The colonel especially was furious, and a great major named Olivier, who was the fire-eater of the regiment, sat opposite to me, curling his huge black moustaches and staring at me as if he would eat me. However, I did not resent his attitude, for I felt that I had indeed been indiscreet, and that it would give a bad impression if upon this, my first evening, I quarrelled with my superior officer. So far I admit that I was wrong, but now I come to the sequel. Supper over, the colonel and some other officers left the room, for it was in a farmhouse that the mess was held. There remained a dozen or so, and a goatskin of Spanish wine having been brought in, we all made merry. Presently, this Major Olivier asked me some questions concerning the army of Germany, and as to the part which I had myself played in the campaign. Flushed with the wine, I was drawn on from story to story. It was not unnatural, my friends. You will sympathize with me. Up there I had been the model for every officer of my years in the army. I was the first swordsman, the most dashing rider, the hero of 100 adventures. Here I found myself not only unknown, but even disliked. Was it not natural that I should wish to tell these brave comrades what sort of man it was that had come among them? Was it not natural that I should wish to say, "Rejoice, my friends, rejoice. It is no ordinary man who has joined you tonight, but it is I, the Gerard, the hero of Ratisbon, the victor of Jena, the man who broke the square at Austerlitz." I could not say all this, but I could at least tell them some incidents which would enable them to say it for themselves. I did so. They listened unmoved. I told them more. At last, after my tale of how I had guided the army across the Danube, one universal shout of laughter broke from them all. I sprang to my feet, flushed with shame and anger. They had drawn me on. They were making game of me. They were convinced that they had to do with a braggart and a liar. Was this my reception in the Hussars of Conflans? I dashed the tears of mortification from my eyes, and they laughed the more at the sight. "Do you know, Captain Petelin, whether Marshal Lannes is still with the army?" asked the Major. "I believe that he is, sir," said the other. "Really? I should have thought that his presence was hardly necessary, now that Captain Gerard has arrived." Again there was a roar of laughter. I can see the ring of faces, the mocking eyes, the open mouths, Olivier with his great black bristles, Pelletan thin and sneering, even the young sub-lieutenants convulsed with merriment. Heavens, the indignity of it! But my rage had dried my tears. I was myself again, cold, quiet, self-contained, ice without and fire within. "May I ask, sir," said I to the major, "at what hour the regiment is paraded?" "I trust, Captain Gerard, that you do not mean to alter our hours," said he, and again there was a burst of laughter, which died away as I looked slowly round the circle. "What hour is the assembly?" I asked sharply of Captain Pelletan. Some mocking answer was on his tongue, but my glance kept it there. "The assembly is at 6," he answered. "I thank you," said I. I then counted the company and found that I had to do with 14 officers, 2 of whom appeared to be boys fresh from St. Cyr. I could not condescend to take any notice of their indiscretion. There remained the major, 4 captains and 7 lieutenants. "Gentlemen," I continued, looking from one to the other of them, "I should feel myself unworthy of this famous regiment if I did not ask you for satisfaction for the rudeness with which you have greeted me, and I should hold you to be unworthy of it if, on any pretext, you refuse to grant it." "You will have no difficulty upon that score," said the major. "I am prepared to waive my rank and to give you every satisfaction in the name of the Hussars of Conflans." "I thank you," I answered. "I feel, however, that I have some claim upon these other gentlemen who laughed at my expense." "Whom would you fight, then?" asked Captain Pelletan. "All of you," I answered. They looked in surprise from one to the other. Then they drew off to the other end of the room, and I heard the buzz of their whispers. They were laughing. Evidently, they still thought that they had to do with some empty braggart. Then they returned. "Your request is unusual," said Major Olivier, "but it will be granted. How do you propose to conduct such a duel? The terms lie with you." "Sabres," said I, "and I will take you in order of seniority, beginning with you, Major Olivier, at 5 o'clock. I will thus be able to devote 5 minutes to each before the assembly is blown. I must, however, beg you to have the courtesy to name the place of the meeting, since I am still ignorant of the locality." They were impressed by my cold and practical manner. Already the smile had died away from their lips. Olivier's face was no longer mocking, but it was dark and stern. "There is a small open space behind the horse lines," said he. "We have held a few affairs of honour there, and it has done very well. We shall be there, Captain Gerard, at the hour you name." I was in the act of bowing to thank them for their acceptance when the door of the mess room was flung open and the colonel hurried into the room with an agitated face. "Gentlemen," said he, "I have been asked to call for a volunteer from among you for a service which involves the greatest possible danger. I will not disguise from you that the matter is serious in the last degree, and that Marshal Lannes has chosen a cavalry officer because he can be better spared than an officer of infantry or of engineers. Married men are not eligible. Of the others, who will volunteer?" I need not say that all the unmarried officers stepped to the front. The colonel looked round in some embarrassment. I could see his dilemma. It was the best man who should go, and yet it was the best man whom he could least spare. "Sir," said I, "may I be permitted to make a suggestion?" He looked at me with a hard eye. He had not forgotten my observations at supper. "Speak," said he. "I would point out, sir," said I, "that this mission is mine, both by right and by convenience." "Why so, Captain Gerard?" "By right, because I am the senior captain. By convenience, because I shall not be missed in the regiments, since the men have not yet learned to know me." The colonel's features relaxed. "There is certainly truth in what you say, Captain Gerard," said he. "I think that you are indeed best fitted to go upon this mission. If you will come with me, I will give you your instructions." I wished my new comrades good night as I left the room, and I repeated that I should hold myself at their disposal at 5 o'clock next morning. They bowed in silence, and I thought that I could see from the expression of their faces that they had already begun to take a more just view of my character. I had expected that the colonel would at once inform me what it was that I had been chosen to do, but instead of that he walked on in silence, I following behind him. We passed through the camp and made our way across the trenches and over the ruined heaps of stones which marked the old wall of the town. Within there was a labyrinth of passages formed among the debris of the houses which had been destroyed by the mines of the engineers. Acres and acres were covered with splintered walls and piles of brick, which had once been a populous suburb. Lanes had been driven through it, and lanterns placed at the corners, with inscriptions to direct the wayfarer. The colonel hurried onward, until at last, after a long walk, we found our way barred by a high grey wall which stretched right across our path. Here, behind a barricade, lay our advance guard. The colonel led me into a roofless house, and there I found two general officers, a map stretched over a drum in front of them, they kneeling beside it and examining it carefully by the light of a lantern. The one with the clean-shaven face and the twisted neck was Marshal Lannes, the other was General Razou, the head of the engineers. "Captain Gerard has volunteered to go," said the colonel. Marshal Lannes rose from his knees and shook me by the hand. "You are a brave man, sir," said he. "I have a present to make to you," he added, handing me a very tiny glass tube. "It has been specially prepared by Dr. Faraday. At the supreme moment you have but to put it to your lips, and you will be dead in an instant." This was a cheerful beginning. I will confess to you, my friends, that a cold chill passed up my back, and my hair rose upon my head. "Excuse me, sir," said I, as I saluted. "I am aware that I have volunteered for a service of great danger, but the exact details have not yet been given to me." "Colonel Perrin," said Lannes severely, "it is unfair to allow this brave officer to volunteer before he has learned what the perils are to which he will be exposed." But already I was myself once more. "Sir," said I, "permit me to remark that the greater the danger, the greater the glory, and that I could only repent of volunteering if I found that there were no risks to be run." It was a noble speech, and my appearance gave force to my words. For the moment I was a heroic figure. As I saw Lannes's eyes fixed in admiration upon my face, it thrilled me to think how splendid was the debut which I was making in the army of Spain. If I died that night, my name would not be forgotten. My new comrades and my old, divided in all else, would still have a point of union in their love and admiration of Etienne Gerard. "General Razou, explain the situation," said Lannes briefly. The engineer officer rose, his compasses in his hand. He led me to the door and pointed to the high grey wall which towered up amongst the debris of the shattered houses. "That is the enemy's present line of defence," said he. "It is the wall of the great convent of the Madonna. If we can carry it, the city must fall. But they have run countermines all round it, and the walls are so enormously thick that it would be an immense labour to breach it with artillery. We happen to know, however, that the enemy have a considerable store of powder in one of the lower chambers. If that could be exploded, the way would be clear for us." "How can it be reached?" I asked. "I will explain. We have a French agent within the town named Hubert. This brave man has been in constant communication with us, and he had promised to explode the magazine. It was to be done in the early morning, and for 2 days running, we have had a storming party of 1,000 grenadiers waiting for the breach to be formed. But there has been no explosion, and for these 2 days we have had no communication from Hubert. The question is, what has become of him.
You wish me to go and see?
Precisely. Is he ill, or wounded, or dead? Shall we still wait for him, or shall we attempt the attack elsewhere? We cannot determine this until we have heard from him.
This is a map of the town, Captain Gerard. You perceive that within this ring of convents and monasteries are a number of streets which branch off from a central square. If you come so far as this square, you will find the cathedral at one corner. In that corner is the street of Toledo. Hubert lives in a small house between a cobbler's and a wine shop, on the right-hand side, as you go from the cathedral. Do you follow me?
Clearly.
You are to reach that house, to see him, and to find out if his plan is still feasible, or if we must abandon it.
He produced what appeared to be a roll of dirty brown flannel.
This is the dress of a Franciscan friar, said he. You will find it the most useful disguise.
I shrank away from it.
It turns me into a spy, I cried. Surely I can go in my uniform.
Impossible. How could you hope to pass through the streets of the city? Remember also that the Spaniards take no prisoners, and that your fate will be the same in whatever dress you are taken.
It was true, and I had been long enough in Spain to know that that fate was likely to be something more serious than mere death. All the way from the frontier, I had heard grim tales of torture and mutilation. I enveloped myself in the Franciscan gown. Now I am ready.
Are you armed?
My sabre?
They will hear it clank. Take this knife and leave your sword. Tell Hubert that at 4 o'clock, before dawn, the storming party will again be ready. There is a sergeant outside who will show you how to get into the city. Good night and good luck.
Before I had left the room, the two generals had their cocked hats touching each other over the map. At the door, an under-officer of engineers was waiting for me. I tied the girdle of my gown, and taking off my busby, I drew the cowl over my head. My spurs I removed. Then, in silence, I followed my guide. End of section 4.
Section 5 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. How the Brigadier Captured Saragossa. Continued. It was necessary to move with caution, for the walls above were lined by the Spanish sentries, who fired down continually at our advance posts. Slinking along under the very shadow of the great convent, we picked our way slowly and carefully among the piles of ruins, until we came to a large chestnut tree. Here the sergeant stopped.
"It is an easy tree to climb," said he. "A scaling ladder would not be simpler. Go up it, and you will find that the top branch will enable you to step upon the roof of that house. After that, it is your guardian angel who must be your guide, for I can help you no more." Girding up the heavy brown gown, I ascended the tree as directed. A half-moon was shining brightly, and the line of roof stood out dark and hard against the purple starry sky. The tree was in the shadow of the house. Slowly I crept from branch to branch until I was near the top. I had but to climb along a stout limb in order to reach the wall, but suddenly my ears caught the patter of feet, and I cowered against the trunk and tried to blend myself with its shadow. A man was coming toward me on the roof. I saw his dark figure creeping along, his body crouching, his head advanced, the barrel of his gun protruding. His whole bearing was full of caution and suspicion. Once or twice he paused, and then came on again until he had reached the edge of the parapet, within a few yards of me. Then he knelt down, levelled his musket, and fired. I was so astonished at this sudden crash at my very elbow that I nearly fell out of the tree.
For an instant I could not be sure that he had not hit me, but when I heard a deep groan from below, and the Spaniard leaned over the parapet and laughed aloud, I understood what had occurred. It was my poor faithful sergeant, who had waited to see the last of me. The Spaniard had seen him standing under the tree, and had shot him. You will think that it was good shooting in the dark, but these people used trabucos, or blunderbusses, which were filled up with all sorts of stones and scraps of metal, so that they would hit you as certainly as I have hit a pheasant on a branch. The Spaniard stood peering down through the darkness, while an occasional groan from below showed that the sergeant was still living. The sentry looked round, and everything was still and safe. Perhaps he thought that he would like to finish off this accursed Frenchman, or perhaps he had a desire to see what was in his pockets. But whatever his motive, he laid down his gun, leaned forward, and swung himself into the tree. The same instant I buried my knife in his body, and he fell with a loud crashing through the branches, and came with a thud to the ground. I heard a short struggle below, and an oath or two in French. The wounded sergeant had not waited long for his vengeance. For some minutes I did not dare to move, for it seemed certain that someone would be attracted by the noise. However, all was silent, save for the chimes striking midnight in the city. I crept along the branch and lifted myself on to the roof. The Spaniard's gun was lying there, but it was of no service to me, since he had the powder horn at his belt. At the same time, if it were found, it would warn the enemy that something had happened, so I thought it best to drop it over the wall. Then I looked round for the means of getting off the roof and down into the city. It was very evident that the simplest way by which I could get down was that by which the sentinel had got up, and what this was soon became evident. A voice along the roof called, "Manuelo! Manuelo!" several times, and crouching in the shadow, I saw in the moonlight a bearded head which protruded from a trap-door. Receiving no answer to his summons, the man climbed through, followed by three other fellows, all armed to the teeth. You will see here how important it is not to neglect small precautions, for had I left the man's gun where I found it, a search must have followed, and I should certainly have been discovered. As it was, the patrol saw no sign of their sentry, and thought, no doubt, that he had moved along the line of the roofs. They hurried on, therefore, in that direction, and I, the instant that their backs were turned, rushed to the open trap-door and descended the flight of steps which led from it. The house appeared to be an empty one, for I passed through the heart of it and out, by an open door, into the street beyond. It was a narrow and deserted lane, but it opened into a broader road, which was dotted with fires, round which a great number of soldiers and peasants were sleeping. The smell within the city was so horrible that one wondered how people could live in it, for during the months that the siege had lasted, there had been no attempt to cleanse the streets or to bury the dead. Many people were moving up and down from fire to fire, and among them I observed several monks. Seeing that they came and went unquestioned, I took heart and hurried on my way in the direction of the great square. Once a man rose from beside one of the fires and stopped me by seizing my sleeve. He pointed to a woman who lay motionless on the road, and I took him to mean that she was dying and that he desired me to administer the last offices of the church. I sought refuge, however, in the very little Latin that was left to me. "Ora pro nobis," said I, from the depths of my cowl. "Te Deum laudamus, ora pro nobis." I raised my hand as I spoke and pointed forward. The fellow released my sleeve and shrank back in silence, while I, with a solemn gesture, hurried upon my way. As I had imagined, this broad boulevard led out into the central square, which was full of troops and blazing with fires. I walked swiftly onward, disregarding one or two people who addressed remarks to me. I passed the cathedral and followed the street which had been described to me. Being upon the side of the city which was farthest from our attack, there were no troops encamped in it, and it lay in darkness, save for an occasional glimmer in a window. It was not difficult to find the house to which I had been directed, between the wine shop and the cobbler's. There was no light within, and the door was shut. Cautiously, I pressed the latch, and I felt that it had yielded. Who was within, I could not tell, and yet I must take the risk. I pushed the door open and entered. It was pitch dark within, the more so as I had closed the door behind me. I felt round and came upon the edge of a table. Then I stood still and wondered what I should do next, and how I could gain some news of this Hubert, in whose house I found myself. Any mistake would cost me not only my life, but the failure of my mission. Perhaps he did not live alone. Perhaps he was only a lodger in a Spanish family, and my visit might bring ruin to him as well as to myself. Seldom in my life have I been more perplexed. And then, suddenly, something turned my blood cold in my veins. It was a voice, a whispering voice, in my very ear. "Mon Dieu!" cried the voice, in a tone of agony. "Oh, mon Dieu, mon Dieu!" Then there was a dry sob in the darkness, and all was still once more. It thrilled me with horror, that terrible voice, but it thrilled me also with hope, for it was the voice of a Frenchman. "Who is there?" I asked. There was a groaning, but no reply. "Is that you, Monsieur Hubert?" "Yes, yes," sighed the voice, so low that I could hardly hear it. "Water, water, for heaven's sake, water!" I advanced in the direction of the sound, but only to come in contact with the wall. Again I heard a groan, but this time there could be no doubt that it was above my head. I put up my hands, but they felt only empty air. "Where are you?" I cried. "Here, here," whispered the strange, tremulous voice. I stretched my hand along the wall, and I came upon a man's naked foot. It was as high as my face, and yet, so far as I could feel, it had nothing to support it. I staggered back in amazement. Then I took a tinder box from my pocket and struck a light. At the first flash, a man seemed to be floating in the air in front of me, and I dropped the box in my amazement. Again, with tremulous fingers, I struck the flint against the steel, and this time I lit not only the tinder but the wax taper. I held it up, and if my amazement was lessened, my horror was increased by that which it revealed. The man had been nailed to the wall, as a weasel is nailed to the door of a barn. Huge spikes had been driven through his hands and his feet. The poor wretch was in his last agony, his head sunk upon his shoulder, and his blackened tongue protruding from his lips. He was dying as much from thirst as from his wounds. And these inhuman wretches had placed a beaker of wine upon the table in front of him to add a fresh pang to his tortures. I raised it to his lips. He had still strength enough to swallow, and the light came back a little to his dim eyes. "Are you a Frenchman?" he whispered. "Yes, they have sent me to learn what had befallen you."
"They discovered me.
They have killed me for it. But before I die, let me tell you what I know. A little more of that wine, please. Quick, quick, I am very near the end. My strength is going. Listen to me. The powder is stored in the Mother Superior's room. The wall is pierced, and the end of the train is in Sister Angela's cell, next the chapel. All was ready 2 days ago, but they discovered a letter, and they tortured me."
"Good heavens! Have you been hanging here for 2 days?"
"It seems like 2 years, comrade. I have served France, have I not? Then do one little service for me. Stab me to the heart, dear friend, I implore you, I entreat you, to put an end to my sufferings." The man was indeed in a hopeless plight, and the kindest action would have been that for which he begged. And yet I could not in cold blood drive my knife into his body, although I knew how I should have prayed for such a mercy had I been in his place. But a sudden thought crossed my mind. In my pocket I held that which would give an instant and a painless death. It was my own safeguard against torture, and yet this poor soul was in very pressing need of it, and he had deserved well of France. I took out my phial and emptied it into the cup of wine. I was in the act of handing it to him when I heard a sudden clash of arms outside the door. In an instant I put out my light and slipped behind the window curtains. Next moment the door was flung open and 2 Spaniards strode into the room, fierce, swarthy men in the dress of citizens, but with muskets slung over their shoulders. I looked through the chink in the curtains in an agony of fear lest they had come upon my traces. But it was evident that their visit was simply in order to feast their eyes upon my unfortunate compatriot. One of them held the lantern which he carried up in front of the dying man, and both of them burst into a shout of mocking laughter. Then the eyes of the man with the lantern fell upon the flagon of wine upon the table. He picked it up, held it with a devilish grin to the lips of Hubert, and then, as the poor wretch involuntarily inclined his head forward to reach it, he snatched it back and took a long gulp himself. At the same instant he uttered a loud cry, clutched wildly at his own throat, and fell stone dead upon the floor. His comrades stared at him in horror and amazement. Then, overcome by his own superstitious fears, he gave a yell of terror and rushed madly from the room. I heard his feet clattering wildly on the cobblestones until the sound died away in the distance. The lantern had been left burning upon the table, and by its light I saw, as I came out from behind my curtain, that the unfortunate Hubert's head had fallen forward upon his chest, and that he also was dead. The motion to reach the wine with his lips had been his last. A clock ticked loudly in the house, but otherwise all was absolutely still. On the wall hung the twisted form of the Frenchman. On the floor lay the motionless body of the Spaniard, all dimly lit by the horn lantern. For the first time in my life a frantic spasm of terror came over me. I had seen 10,000 men in every conceivable degree of mutilation stretched upon the ground, but the sight had never affected me like those two silent figures who were my companions in that shadowy room. I rushed into the street as the Spaniard had done, eager only to leave that house of gloom behind me, and I had run as far as the cathedral before my wits came back to me. There I stopped, panting in the shadow, and, my hand pressed to my side, I tried to collect my scattered senses and to plan out what I should do. As I stood there, breathless, the great brass bells roared twice above my head. It was 2 o'clock. 4 was the hour when the storming party would be in its place. I had still 2 hours in which to act. End of section 5.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.